Please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now seated. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. The Supreme Court of Texas is convened in Tyler for the first time since 1891. Our court in its early days rode circuit, and from 1850 to 1869 and from 1874 until 1891, the court was not only in Austin, but was also located in Galveston and Tyler in roughly equal proportion. A constitutional amendment in 1891 creating the Court of Criminal Appeals was accompanied by an enabling statute that put us in Austin only, and the judges, perhaps weary of traveling, eventually got another constitutional amendment passed that said they could not ever sit outside of the capital city. I suppose that worked reasonably well for a time, but our court became convinced that it would serve the ends of justice and help people become more acquainted with how our courts operate if from time to time we went back onto the road. It also, we felt, would serve the ends of justice if we could make emergency rulings while we were all out of town at a bar convention or some type of continuing education seminar. And so we asked the legislature to give the people of Texas an opportunity to repeal that amendment that kept us solely in Austin, and the people did so in 1997. And twice a year, we now go on the road, and we are very happy to be back in Tyler after a 111-year hiatus. Justice Hankinson could not join us. She had a personal emergency, but the other members of the court are here, and all of us will sit in the deliberation and decision of the two cases which we will hear today. In the order of their presentation, they are Walmart Stores versus Martin Rodriguez, a case from Bexar County, which we are taking from its appeal to the 4th Appellate District Court. And second, Texas Farm Bureau Mutual Insurance Companies versus Mr. and Mrs. James Sears from McLennan County and the 10th Appellate District. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument. And we are now ready to hear from petitioner in Walmart versus Rodriguez.
May it please the court, Mr. Doug Alexander will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This is actually an historic occasion for two reasons. This is the first time the court has sat in Tyler since 1891, and it's the first time that the court has revisited the issues involved in this case since 1898. False imprisonment, Your Honors, is an intentional tort. To be actionable, the lawsuit must be predicated upon knowing misconduct on the part of the defendant. Mere negligence or other mistake in providing information to the authorities does not give rise to liability, even if it results in a misidentification of the plaintiff and ultimately leads to arrest and imprisonment. Rather, to be actionable, the citizen must go further and actually specifically request or direct the police to make the apprehension. Probably the clearest statement of the contours of request to direct appears in the restatement second of torts, section 45A, comment C, and it's put very simply as this. The words or actions must arise to the level of this. Officer, arrest that man. In this case, we don't have any evidence of knowing misconduct. At best, we have evidence, summary judgment evidence, of negligent conduct on behalf of Walmart. There is no evidence in this case that Walmart knew that any of the information it provided was false. There is no evidence even that Walmart had serious doubts as to the information that appeared on the form that was provided. I think that there are three cases in particular that this court should focus on in order to get an idea of the contours of false imprisonment. The first one is the grandfather case, a decision by this court, Josh P. v. Irvine. That's the case that was decided in 1898. That is the case that uses the language request or direct. In other words, to be actionable, there must be an actual request or direct by the citizen to make the arrest. That language is consistent with the instigation language that the court will find in the restatement, 45A comment C, which deals with instigation. And there's no real reason for this court at this point to depart from the rule that was laid down in 1898. The second case the court should look at, I believe, is Smith versus Snead. It's a decision by the eminent former jurist Woody Jones that deals with the issue of false imprisonment. And that is a case that makes clear that mere mistakenly providing information to the police, mistaken information, cannot give rise to liability unless the citizen goes further and actually directs the arrest. The final case that the court should scrutinize very, very closely is the case of Leon's Shoe Stores. It's a 1957 decision by the Waco Court of Appeals. It really is the case on which the Court of Appeals decision in this case turned. It's the case. Because what the Court of Appeals determined in this case was that the failure by Walmart to make full disclosure of material facts was sufficient for liability to attach. Now, if you read the Leon's Shoe Store case superficially, there will be a clear understanding as to how that came about. One of the things I would urge the court to do is to have one of the briefing attorneys' law clerks key cite Leon's Shoes, see what other courts of appeals have done in handling that case. And what the court will find is that there's not really a body of law that has developed setting forth a duty to disclose. However, the duty to disclose language appears in Leon's Shoes. The court held in Leon's Shoes that there was a duty on behalf, under the circumstances of that case, there was a duty on behalf of the citizens. In this case, it was a Cinderella shoe shop or something like that, to make full disclosure. Now, what the court will see is when you focus on that duty language, and it's really critical, that there is no citation to any authority. There isn't. It's merely a bald statement that's made. But it's understandable, I believe, and I've been struggling with the decision because it is not a model of clarity. It is not a model of clarity. However, when you really study it, focus on what the credit manager in that case said and did. What did the credit manager do? Because I think what you will find is that in that case, the conduct of the credit manager came as close as you can possibly get to being a knowing misrepresentation.
I'm a little bit confused on where you're drawing the line between knowing misrepresentation and request or direct. I mean, are you saying that as long as this form is filled out, then there can never be liability, even if intentional misinformation is put on here, because it's not a request or direct for arrest?
No. Apparently, where the court, and I will tell you this, your confusion is understandable because the line is not cleanly drawn in the cases. Let me get my best stab.
Your answer to my question is no.
No, it is not no. So I think no because my answer to the way you framed your question is liability could attach. Okay, because the word I heard you use was knowingly provide information.
Well, that seems to me to be the proper focus. When you say
yes,
that this cannot be a request or direct for an arrest, then it just seems to me that that theory says that as long as you turn this over to the DA and the decision is left up to him, this can never be the basis of liability. But it seems like the more appropriate inquiry is, was the information on this document intentionally false?
That's the inquiry.
So request or direct is really irrelevant.
Let me nuance that for you, because you've hit the nub, okay? And let's spend some time on that. And as I said, the case law isn't crystal clear on this, but let me give it my best stab. If you deliberately provide false information to the authorities, if you deliberately withhold material information, it appears that the case law would say that liability can attach. The key is, was it done deliberately?
But so that's the focus, rather than request or direct.
That's fine. Yes. Let's focus on that. Let's focus on that. Now, what happened here?
Let me ask you, if you agree with Justice O'Neill, then are you saying that the cases you cite that talk about direct are not applicable to this scenario because we're going to look at a different standard or elements of whether there's liability?
I think that that is a way to look at it. I think that that's the way to look at it. I mean, the way that the cases are stated, and let me just say that the way that they're stated, then let's work backwards.
Having said that, that then takes care of two of the three cases that you discussed. Is that right? And we get to Hornsby as whether that case will support the claim by the Rodriguez.
I think Hornsby is the key case. I agree.
Well, the Court of Appeals cited the Boston versus Tober.
It cited Boston. Let me tell you what Boston did. Boston merely cited Hornsby. And in one sentence, this is what it says. The lack of full disclosure to the authorities may result in liability. That's the extent of the discussion of Boston. It's important to note that in Boston, the ruling, it was a summary judgment case, in my recollection, and ultimately the judgment was for the defendants. Okay? So it's not a case in which the Boston court was saying you can have, was in fact predicating liability on a failure to disclose. So Boston was merely essentially parroting Hornsby and moving on. So Hornsby is the key. Hornsby is the key case.
So you think this statement that was filed was a request or was not a request?
Oh, in the way the courts have looked at this, it was not a request. It was the provision of information to the authorities.
Why would you provide it if you did, a merchant? Why would a merchant provide this information if he didn't hope that there would be a prosecution?
Here's why. What do they hope for? In this case, they hope to get back $197. Okay. They hope that maybe the authorities would phone this person, write this person, get the money back by means short of arrest.
Well, wait, in other words, it's signed by a complainant.
Correct.
Do you have this in front of you?
I have it firmly in my brain.
Well, then recite from memory the last sentence.
Okay. Based upon my best understanding, and actually it's cut off, you'll see, but basically it's based upon the information provided here is provided based on the best of my knowledge, and my understanding is that
if charges are filed, a warrant will be issued for the maker who may be placed in jail.
If charges are filed, it does not say filed charges. That's a big distinction in the case law.
But it's a complainant.
It's a complainant saying, I lost $197. The person walked out of my store with $197 worth. I want the money back.
I didn't know that any person had the right to tell the police to file charges. I thought that there was always an element of official discretion.
Well, this is what's really interesting about it. This is go back to the restatement. Officer, arrest that man. That's the standard. In other words, when we talk about if we're back to request or direct, it really is going that far.
So would you arrest that man, or might you consider arresting that man is not enough?
Yes, not enough. And here's the key, and this is so critical, and then I want to get back to discussing the contours of Hornsby again. I think it is fair to say, and once again we're in the summary judgment context, so I don't want to gild the lily in terms of the evidence. I need to slam my client, because we're in summary judgment land. It was arguably reasonably foreseeable that the provision of the information that appears in that form could lead to the arrest.
Well, but isn't it more than that? I mean, isn't it well known that throughout Texas, maybe the whole country, that when merchants have hot checks, they send them over to the DA, and they hope that the DA will wring the money out of them one way or the other.
Well, you just used the magic words, one way or the other. Okay. In other words, what's fallen short of, and you just get this in the case law when you read through it, is the request correct? In other words, there's prosecutorial discretion. The hands are not tied. What we're trying to encourage is citizens providing information. What we're hoping for is that when you have a situation like this, in which the prosecutor, I mean, look at it from the standpoint of the prosecutor, looking at a form, do you see a single name on that form? No. Do you see, is there a blank space? There's a question, again. Can you identify, positively identify this person in court? What's the answer? Blank. What's the prosecutor doing arresting in the situation? Was that requested? No. Now, back to your question in Hornsby.
My understanding was that you sort of conceded this is a rabbit trail. The real issue is the intent of the person who filled out.
Let's get back to it. If you, and this is the way the cases seem to shake out, and again, they are not models of clarity.
What it boils down to is, can the failure to disclose information constitute an intentional tort?
If it is done deliberately. That's the key language, knowingly.
There's a difference between deliberately and knowingly. I think deliberately gets closer to a malicious intent, but I want you to answer me on this. It says Rodriguez introduced evidence that Walmart knew that its identification system could provide an erroneous driver's license number in relation to a company check. And if they had fully disclosed that fact and given the information, that would have disproved Rodriguez's complicity. Finally, that these kind of issues are questions of fact for the jury rather than a legal question of, as you argue.
Yeah. Okay, and this again, and we're into, I want to stick with the Hornsby.
The question though is,
is that enough?
They've stated, is that enough to raise a fact question so that Walmart wasn't entitled to a summary judgment?
No.
And why not? Because it wasn't deliberately done?
Because it wasn't, and let me quote other language from the Court of Appeals opinion. These are quotes. No evidence was presented to show that Walmart knew the information it provided was false.
Well, now you're talking about the
form.
No, you're talking about the malicious prosecution.
I am. I'm lifting language from other sections in the opinion.
Which has totally different elements and is not an issue. Would you say that when they say what they said over here in the false arrest case and what they said over here in the malicious prosecution are internally, there's some tension there?
Not from the standpoint of whether, on the question of intent, on scienter. This is the key. Scienter is the key, because for there to be a false arrest, and I cannot make this point any more strongly stated, you must knowingly, deliberately, you pick the word, I don't think there's that much decision difference, provide false information. You must know that the information you're providing is false, or you must deliberately withhold it. Let me get back to Hornsby, focus on the credit manager. In that case, unlike in our case, and this is why they end up using the language, I believe, and as I said, not a model of clarity, and really the only case that says this in Texas or anywhere else in terms of the duty. The credit manager knew this woman. What we had, let me use the biblical analogy. Okay, right before the crucifixion, what did Peter say three times? I do not know him. Okay, that's what the credit manager did. The credit manager knew that this woman that was being hauled off to jail had an account with a store. Knew that the check that was being written was under circumstances that there should be no prosecution. And when directly asked by the police, essentially, do you know this woman? No, I think there's another woman that has an account with our store, but not this woman. It is truly a knowing misrepresentation case. That distinction is critical. So back to your question, can a failure to disclose be actionable? Yes, if. Knowingly. That's the distinction. And there is no evidence of that here. And Justice Baker, why am I drawing on the malicious prosecution part of the deal, part of the libel part of that case? Because that's where the discussion that really is material here, that is the scienter element, appears, not in the false arrest. Because the mistake that the Court of Appeals made in this case, the mistake the court made was to take this global, take the language in Hornsby completely out of context without any authorities and say, ah, there is a duty, to duty in a negligent sense.
Well, they're not going to say it's a negligent sense. I don't suppose they're going to concede they've operated on a negligence theory. The other side, they're going to say that you knew the system was bad. You knew that the driver's license number had no relationship to the company.
And therefore what? You could. Did they know that the name that appeared in the driver's license number wasn't the maker? Did they know that? No. And this is the key. So based upon what they knew, they could reasonably foresee that this is something that could happen. That is a negligence analysis. That is a negligence analysis.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. John Gary, present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Perhaps to better understand the issues involved in the case here today, a brief review of the check cashing policy of Walmart would be helpful. I've provided the members of the court with a handout there, which I see y'all been looking at, which has a copy of the complaint as well as the front and reverse of the check in question.
Well, before you do that, you would agree that this is an intentional tort.
Yes, ma'am, I would.
And negligence won't get you there.
I agree.
So what are you relying on to prove intent?
The fact that Walmart, at the time that it prepared and filed this complaint, knew that its check cashing verification system, a system which it implemented, was trained on, that they knew that that particular system was defective in this particular instance and in the instance of any checks where there were multiple signers, for example, even a husband and wife account. Because the way the system operates is the first person that comes into Walmart and presents a check, for example, a business check or a husband and wife check, Walmart requires that that person produce personal identification.
Go from there. If that's the case, if knowing you have a defective investigation system or reporting system is enough to get you false imprisonment, then couldn't you raise a fact issue in every case? People that do background checks, if for some reason it's not thorough enough system with enough checks and balances, then somehow that can rise to the level of an intentional tort.
Well, certainly if it's done knowingly. And in this particular case, there's a wealth of knowing conduct on the part of Walmart to result in the false imprisonment of my client, Mr. Rodriguez. Again, going back to the way their system works, the first person comes in, they take that individual's driver's license, they look at it, they take that driver's license number, and then they put it in their system, and for every other person who presents that particular check, a business check, a husband and wife check, that driver's license number is automatically used as the identification for that purpose.
And is there evidence of other arrests having occurred because of this problem with the identification system?
I don't know of any other, Your Honor.
So how would Walmart know? I mean, if there's no evidence that there was a pattern of false arrest based on that system, how would Walmart know, or why should we charge them with intentional conduct in terms of this particular case?
Well, their own agents and servants testified that they knew that this was the a deficiency in the system and that it could result in a false imprisonment.
But they also know human nature is fallible. Employees could make mistakes and arrests happen for that reason as well. What I'm asking is, if there's no evidence that there's a pattern or some sort of systemic problem that has resulted in false arrest, how can we charge Walmart with intentional conduct in this case?
Well, because, Your Honor, what they did is they presented a complaint to the Hays County Criminal District Attorney's Office. And if you take a look at behind tab 2, a copy of that complaint is provided to court. The final line there before the complainant for Walmart signs, it says, I hereby swear the above information is true, is correct, and it's complete.
Well, what's wrong with that? I mean, They took the name of the maker and the address off the check. Isn't that a reasonable thing to do?
Well, it would be reasonable, Your Honor. It would be correct, except in this case and under the circumstances here, what happened is they took the name of the drawer, which was RNC Enterprise, not the maker. Now, Walmart knew and understood what the maker was, and the testimony was from their own agents and servants that they understood that the maker is the person that signs the check. RNC Enterprises was the company account upon which that check was drawn. So they knew that the maker of the check had been an individual, not a corporation, because they provide, and you have to look at this complaint in the whole context.
The DA knows that. When the district attorney looks at this, he can see that KNC Enterprises is an entity and can't sign a check.
And I understand that. And the district attorney also sees where you look down two more lines where a driver's license is provided, which is the driver's license number of my client. And the district attorney's office also knows that that driver's license number is easily ascertained as to the identity of a person. And that goes to an individual and not a corporation. And so on the one hand, Walmart falsely provided the maker of the check. And on the other hand, they falsely represented that Rodriguez was, in fact, the maker when he was not.
Is this also actually partly a problem of the DA's office? I mean, during the investigation, shouldn't the DA have made a call either to Walmart or to RNC or to the holder of this driver's license number to verify whether, who actually wrote the check and whether there's a problem with that?
Yes, they could have, Your Honor. And in fact, certainly investigation is the law enforcement and prosecutorial function. But the problem with that is that investigation by the prosecutors and law enforcement is based on the information that's provided to them. Now, the information that was provided by Walmart says the possessor of this driver's license number 07550777 was guilty of theft by check. Okay. Now, that was sufficient information for a prosecutor then to go forward and prosecute Rodriguez based on that information.
Well, let's go
it
backwards.
Would be no different.
Excuse me, Mr. Gowen, let's go backwards a little bit. Is there any evidence that the cashier who took this check, the back of which had this driver's license put on it, know that the driver's license number that was being put on that check did not belong to the person that signed the check?
Now, I don't know that the cashier had actual knowledge that it did not belong to the maker of the check, but they did have knowledge, Your Honor.
Well, they just know how the system works.
Took a driver's license number, which may or may not be the correct individual.
The cashier that puts this check in the system, knowing the driver's license is going to be going on there, does not know, and there's no evidence that they knew that the person that was writing this check was not the person who wrote the first check.
That's correct, but they should have.
Now, does the person who takes the first check, going back to the first check that's given, and the person presents it, the cashier is taking the person who presents the check at his word that he signs on that account. He's a signer on the account, right? Because otherwise he wouldn't accept the check. He wouldn't.
That may be, Your Honor. Perhaps the boss could sign the check and send the employee down there, and Walmart uses the driver's license number because they've got a live body at the other end of that,
and
they can hold responsible.
We do know on the first check presented that this person does have the authority to sign on that check, and the driver's license number is put on the back of that check, right?
That's correct. Or has the authority to take the check down there. Now, whether Rodriguez actually signed his signature on there or not, I don't even know whether that question was even asked. My understanding is on this particular check, obviously that came back, Rex Long did.
So if in these circumstances I fill out, Walmart fills out the charge sheet and gives truthful information, this check has the following information on it, but fails to tell the police that we don't know whether the person that signed this check matches up with the driver's license number. They say, we don't know that. And the police department goes out and finds Rodriguez, and they pick him up for questioning. And Rodriguez says, I didn't sign that check. And then they call and they find out Mr. Long actually signed this check, and he says he signed it, and they don't arrest Mr. Long. And they release Rodriguez. How would the outcome in this case have been different?
In other words, had Walmart made full disclosure?
Which is what you're arguing here.
That's right. Had they made full disclosure, we wouldn't be here.
Would they have still picked up Rodriguez based on the driver's license number and questioned him about it and determined that, well, he didn't sign this check, and then call Mr. Long and find out he actually wrote on the check?
They may well have been able to call Mr. Rodriguez and simply ask him and have him come down voluntarily, take a look at the check. People do that all the time, come down to the district attorney's office voluntarily. District attorneys call people in for investigative purposes and things like that.
But
at least they would have had the opportunity to come in.
But isn't that the fault of the DA's office, not making the call first, as opposed to just running part of this information into the warrants database?
No, because they were misinformed by and misrepresented by Walmart as to the true nature of the facts. Walmart represented that the possessor of this driver's license number was guilty of theft by check. Walmart failed to represent to the district attorney's office that its own system was so defective that this may or may not be the correct maker of the check. Had they provided that information to the law enforcement and district attorney authorities, then they would have been able to exercise intelligent discretion as to whether or not to effect Rodriguez's arrest. And that's the key to the whole thing.
What's the difference between that and negligence?
Well, this was done knowingly. They knew their system was inherently defective. They knew they failed to provide the district attorney's office with that critical information, which was material, and certainly tended to prove or pretend to prove Rodriguez's innocence. But this is exculpatory information that they withheld.
As Judge Jefferson asked earlier, they also know that employees sometimes write the number down wrong. Should they tell that?
Well, if they know, well, first of all, I don't think we can cover every instance where a person makes an honest mistake, okay? And if it's an honest mistake, the case law is very clear that there's no liability.
I'm trying to find out the difference between an honest mistake and just thinking this is so unlikely to happen that it never crossed our minds to tell, and what you say is a deliberate mistake.
And it may well be that honest mistakes are unlikely, they happen infrequently, and when they do, of course, there's no liability. Why? Because the person was truthful. Now, they made an honest mistake, but they were truthful. They disclosed the information. In this particular instance, we have Walmart withholding information that is material and vital to Rodriguez's guilt or innocence.
You and the petitioner have both essentially abandoned the direct or request language of Joski here.
Well, certainly not the respondent. We understand the request and direct language of Joski's and the rest of the cases, okay?
But
in requesting and directing,
the argument has focused on whether there's a misstatement.
Well, and the misstatement goes to whether or not requesting or directing occurred, because here's how it applies. The misinformation, the misrepresentation is applicable to the directing and requesting element of a false imprisonment and false arrest case simply because the information that is provided becomes determinative of whether or not the authorities effect an arrest. It's not the authorities' own discretion and own judgment that caused Rodriguez's arrest. It was the false misrepresentation, the suppression of information by Walmart, which resulted in the arrest. And of course, the case law.
I don't see how a request is any less a request because the information that is provided is false, or any more a request because the information provided is true.
Well, because the authorities, of course, are going to rely on the information that's provided to them. And of course, they have the discretion to effect an arrest or not, and they have that in every single case. And if that was the test, then we wouldn't have false imprisonment in Texas, because ultimately law enforcement and prosecutorial authorities will always have the discretion whether or not to effect an arrest. The question comes down to the informant, the citizen who's reporting criminal activity and conduct. If he makes full disclosure, if he fairly presents the information, then the prosecutors and law enforcement can intelligently exercise their discretion based on that information to investigate, to not investigate, to effect an arrest, whatever needs to be done. The directing and requesting can also occur in the cases where you misrepresent and withhold information. Because it's your conduct which overrides that of prosecutorial authorities that results in the arrest.
But you'd agree that that's a bit of a slippery slope, because then any time anyone makes a report to police, quite often it can be claimed that they didn't give the whole story. They left a little something out, and under your construct, that would get them there. I mean, doesn't there have to be some evidence of animus toward the individual? Doesn't there have to be some evidence that Walmart had it out for Rodriguez specifically, as opposed to just giving information that ended up not being the whole story, but there's no evidence that somebody wanted to falsely depict Rodriguez as a hot check passer?
Animus is not a required element in false imprisonment. Certainly in malicious prosecution it is. Here, we're just talking about, did you direct or request an arrest? Okay? In the obvious instance...
But I thought we were back to that was really the first question before direct or request was intent.
Well, it figures in here because it's the intentional conduct of Walmart suppresses the information, which leads to the directing of the arrest, or directs the arrest, in effect, because the discretion of prosecutorial authorities is so jaded by the misinformation that's provided.
If it's an intentional tort, doesn't the intent have to be directed at Rodriguez here?
I think the intentional aspect has to be directed toward the arrest, not the animus of Rodriguez, or any animus towards Rodriguez. In other words, the intent of Walmart here is to get their money. Now, they'd like to get it by the phone call from the DA, but the information they provided on the form, of course, is false. They're never going to reach my client because the information is not correct. Okay? The DA has no way to reach the client. They rely on Walmart's giving us his driver's license number saying this man committed theft by check, and so we effect the arrest based on that information. Okay? Because Walmart, this is not just a case of somebody making a report to authorities. This is somebody who's swearing that the information is true and correct.
And it was. It was true and correct to the best information of the person who filled it out, that we have a check that has the following information on it. What your case is because Walmart set up a system that made it possible to misidentify the sign on the check, not the maker. The maker is accurately... The maker of the check is accurately depicted on the report. But because it makes it possible to give information that might not be correct, that is, the signer of the check isn't the one whose driver's license is here, you're saying that this is false imprisonment. Isn't what you've given at most a reckless conduct or disregard? Maybe it's gross negligence here, but isn't that still one step removed from an intentional tort?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe this is clearly falls within the parameters of an intentional tort. Walmart knew what it was doing. This was not a mistake. They knew what their system was capable of and incapable of. And when they swore that this was true and correct without advising the authorities of the exculpatory side of the story, which was that we've given you a driver's license number, but truth and fact, we don't know whether this is that of the maker. Okay? Now that would send up a red flag to any prosecutorial authorities or law enforcement to investigate first before effecting arrest. And that's the whole key here. It's the conduct on the part of Walmart which in effect overrides the discretion of the prosecutorial authorities because they're relying on this information as being true, correct, and complete. And Walmart, of course, does this over and over again. This is not the first time they send a check over for collection. They understand that by doing this, individuals can be arrested.
But just as Walmart knew this could not be exactly correct, so the DA would have to know that as well. I mean, he'd have to know that K&C Enterprises did not have a driver's license.
Well, what the DA would have to know is that the driver's license number provided was maybe that of the maker or maybe not. And the chances of 50-50 are better that it wasn't, and certainly in this case, it wasn't. Well, and Walmart knew that.
There's no chance at all it could be the driver's license of K&C Enterprises.
Well, I mean of Rex Long, the person who passed the hot check. But again, the policy issues here, I think, are paramount. Again, the matter of full and fair disclosure is applicable to the false imprisonment cases because the underlying philosophy of the directing and requesting is that the defendant's role, rather than that of the authorities, is what activates or motivates the arrest. The failure to disclose has a material bearing on whether or not an individual is arrested. Walmart's argument that it shouldn't be liable for false imprisonment because the district attorney's office or law enforcement should have made an investigation is without merit. They misrepresented the facts to law enforcement, and they now cannot complain of their culpable misconduct by saying, well, district attorney, you should have known better that we were providing you with false information. And that's the position that they've taken here.
Do you think Texas law is the same as Section 45A of the Restatement of Torts, Second?
I think the Restatement of Torts gives a very good example. I think the law in the state of Texas is that the lack of full disclosure will result in liability where the defendant knows that there's exculpatory information, that they withheld that information from prosecutorial authorities, then liability would attach. The policy should be to promote full and fair disclosure rather than allow for misrepresentation. To permit parties to misrepresent and provide false information would reward that kind of conduct and result in innocent citizens, such as Rodriguez, being subjected to false imprisonment.
But again, Walmart had, at the time that this complaint was filed, Walmart only knew the possibility that this information might not be true, but they did not know that this information was affirmatively false.
They knew the information could not be true, or could be, and they had a duty to disclose that, because that has a material bearing on whether or not to direct or effect an arrest.
But you agree that the information they provided, they did not know was false at the time they provided the information.
They provided false information. No doubt about that.
They did not know it was false.
Well, they knew it was false when they said that, look, we're providing you true, correct, and complete information
here. Maybe I misunderstood. I suggested that Walmart knew that information could or could not be true. But when they provided this information, they did not know that the driver's license number on the check was not the driver's license number of the person who wrote out the check.
They may well not have known that precisely, but what the complaint says is that this is true, correct, and complete information as to the whole picture. What Walmart did was gave the DA a half of a picture. They tore the picture in half.
They didn't tell them that based on their business keeping records, they couldn't affirm that driver's license number actually belonged to whoever signed that.
Absolutely. And that would have completed the information, and that exculpatory information would have then allowed the prosecutor to make an intelligent decision as to whether to effect Rodriguez's arrest or not. And therein, that misrepresentation, that failure to provide full fair disclosure, resulted in the arrest of Rodriguez.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
What he said, a phenomenon happened to me. The line of questioning by Justice Enoch hits it on the head and puts it better than any way I put it. We're down to the nub. Let me just go over this and really go over what is undisputed, and then we can decide what the significance of that is. This is the driver's license number, undisputedly. Is this the maker of the check? No. So from that standpoint, was this information false? Yes. Did Walmart know when it furnished this information, this is what was furnished to the authorities, that this wasn't the maker? No, it did not know that. Now, what they want to do is, should Walmart be proud of this document?
But there's other evidence in the record, such as Walmart's policy, when you can't read the signature.
And the
name printed below. Secondly, when it's over $100, to get personal ID, which I presume would be another driver's license, with Mr. Long's driver's license number on it.
Let me read from the Fifth Circuit, and actually I apologize because this is a clean statement of it. It's not inconsistent with other cases, but let me give you the cite. Campbell versus City of San Antonio, 43 F 3rd, 973, at footnote 18, boils down to this. The tort of false arrest is predicated upon knowing misconduct, negligence, or other mistake in providing incorrect information to lawful authorities does not give rise to liability. What you're talking about, Justice Baker, and I think it's an important point, is if we go back a few steps from this information, they and again, in the summary judgment land, they weren't following their policies. Okay, they had a system that was not foolproof. With 2020 hindsight, back to you, Justice Enix, perhaps they should have been able to foresee that this could result. And what you'll see in the evidence is could have, should have, could have, should have. When you read this record as could have, should have, it's negligence language.
Do I understand that the endorsement that we see on the check is an electronic endorsement which is put on the check every time?
Correct.
And is it correct that the driver's license that appears on that electronic endorsement is because this was the first check by RNC that was brought in and they got Mr. Rodriguez's driver's license?
Correct.
So every check after that will have only his on it unless they follow their procedure.
Correct.
And they know that.
Correct.
And here they didn't know who it was who cashed this check when it was NSF.
Correct.
So would you say there is some knowing conduct because of the deficiency in the system itself?
No.
And why not?
Because this is the information that's provided. Everything that you've just said, everything that you've just said, relates to, let's go backwards from what was provided here. What, were they negligent? Let's back to you. Could you call that reckless? Could you call that gross negligence? Perhaps. Again, we're in the summary judgment context. But when they provided this document to the authorities, this is the document, did they know it was false? No. Again, should we be proud of this? No.
Is there ever a level of non-disclosure that you believe could rise to the level of intentional conduct?
Sure, if it's done, if it's Hornsby.
Well, no. I understand Hornsby, yeah, it was a failure to disclose, but you knew the identity of it. I mean, could you ever have a situation, as, say, Justice Jefferson posited, where they know that people are being hauled in on hot checks under a defective system, and there's a level of knowledge there that this is happening, and if they continue to do it, can that rise to the level of...
Well, we're back to your slippery slope, which I think is an excellent question. You could perhaps hypothecate a case where, based upon a record that we don't have here, where there's person after person after person is being pulled in, that arises to that level. We don't have that here. So I think that you perhaps could hypothecate. But of course, we're stuck with this case. And what we have is a situation where we don't have any evidence of that. And what we have is a situation where it's kind of like, well, could you have done this different? And mind you, this computer system is not just used by Walmart. It's used by a bunch of other people, and it's not foolproof. But we get back to the could have, should have. Well, could you have done more? Should you have done more? What is that language? Is that intent language? No. That is negligence language. And everything that Justice Baker is talking about, and he's making, I mean, perfectly legitimate points, they're all what's back here that should have placed them on some sort of notice from a negligence standpoint.
I have one quick question. Petitioner's brief. We're cited to Texas Business and Commerce Code Section 3.103 for the definition of maker. What's your contention, Art? Is the maker both the corporation and the individual who signed?
Oh, excellent.
Who is the maker in this case?
The short answer is, I don't know. I believe the maker is the one who signs it. But the short answer is, I don't know.
Because the code says the person who signs or is identified in the note as a person undertaking the payment. So.
Okay, I can't answer that question. I confess ignorance as to technically whether it would be RNC or the person who signed.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause, and the court will now take a brief recess.